Welcome to Indefinable Magic, random musings inspired by some aspect, big or small, integral or adjacent to, a long-running TV series about travelling in space and time in a police box. Written and presented by me, Toby Haydock. In these bite-sized editions, the subject matter will be inspired by a single watch of the very latest episode of that series, which you may have heard of. It's called Doctor Who. And so, tonight's instalment of Indefinable Magic, Bite Size, after The Devil's Court, written by Russell T. Davis, is called Play On. Songs that lift you and devastate you, and then make you soar. Look, I'm not a musical person. I just don't know much about it. But I know what I like. And what I liked most about The Devil's Chord was that beautiful shot of the Doctor and Ruby disappearing into the TARDIS wardrobe and then emerging, bedecked in a postcard 60s chic, looking, and yes, in Doctor Who, really cool. And it wasn't just the costumes, for they were accompanied by music. A song. A funky, evocative, yep, cool song. California Soul by Marlena Shaw. And no, I didn't know what the song was called until I looked it up for this. Oh, you know, I'd heard it. I recognised that opening. And when hard pressed, I might have mustered a derba 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 California something. But the proper name and the singer? Nope. And yes, I've just learnt too that it wasn't released until 1967, so is strictly speaking, in The Devil's Chord, an anachronism. But the one way to prove that you're not cool is to try and make cool correct. It's cool! It's too busy being cool to worry about being accurate. Now listen, I love accurate, but that's one of the reasons I'm not cool. But I'm not going to start to tell cool how to behave. It can choose whatever soundtrack it likes. If you want to measure cool, to make cool play by the rules, to make cool be accurate, well, you may as well try to catalogue a rainbow, make an inventory of yearning, draw up a roster of melancholia, quantify an orgasm. I've done none of those things, by the way, though I am one hell of a rosterer. I'm a roster doister. But neither am I cool, nor am I musical. In fact, this week, I went to what must be only my fifth concert ever, to watch Bruce Springsteen in, of all places, Cardiff, the home of Doctor Who, the Dream Factory, where long-running cultural big hitters display their timeless brilliance and show no signs of flagging, despite relatively great age. A friend of mine, you see, is a proper Bruce aficionado, who speaks of his hero with a glint in his eye, and he knows the names of all the band members. What a geek. He knows the history and association with the main man, who is not really addressed by his name, but rather his title. The Boss. The definite article, you might say. My friend had urged me to join him at this concert. This was his thing, and he felt that I'd appreciate it. Now, it's definitely not my thing music. I'm a bit too uptight and self-conscious about public displays of jiggery. But when unobserved, and it's a tune I know, I might have been known to occasionally bust some moves. And besides, as several of my exes will tell you, I've never been shy about trying to get people I care about to enjoy my thing. And if you've ever topped a romantic night out by popping Frontios on the telly, then you'll know what I mean. Oh, did I mention? Yeah, I'm not cool. So, as I stood awkwardly in a Cardiff stadium, I decided to try to appreciate Springsteen from the perspective of the people watching with me. Lots of them my age and older, clutching onto childhood nostalgia, anchoring themselves in the sounds and words and people who moved and excited them when they were young. A cultural phenomenon still producing the goods. There was also a remarkable number of young people in the crowd too, who I initially, if I'm honest, found quite annoying, especially the lad next to me who barged into me by accident just once too often. These days, though, I try hard in these circumstances to be more circumspect and empathic, so I was determined not to be annoyed by him, not to let him spoil my evening. And he was, after all, having fun. It was hard, though, as he'd occasionally wolf whistle during a deliberately orchestrated, quiet, contemplative moment in the gig. "Read the stadium," I thought, testily. But then, when Springsteen thanked us for coming, there was genuine emotion in this young man's voice as he called out, "I love you, Bruce!" sounding like that vulnerable child that, I think, lives within us all, and pulls us back to those times when we needed someone to make us feel both safe and excited, comforted and thrilled. The year after Doctor Who started, Bruce played with his first band. He talked about its inception from the stage. "They were called the Castiles," cried out this fella, excited to be able to chip in and display his knowledge, delighted that he knew it, like a child pleased to tell teacher, or a Doctor Who fan pointing something out. He wasn't, "I think you're finding Bruce," though. Bruce couldn't hear him anyway. He was joining in. He was sharing his passion. This jostling man-child who had irked me so. In that moment, I loved him, and his exhibition of sheer, unself-conscious devotion. He even wept when Bruce invoked now-deceased members of his band, and they lived again briefly through archive footage and Bruce's spoken tribute. "So long as they're here," said Bruce, grasping his heart, "they're with us." My friend, Matt, later told me that Bruce had been inspired back in 1964 to get his first guitar when he'd seen the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, those same Beatles who were a key part of Doctor Who's latest episode, The Devil's Chord. Bruce even finished with not one of his classics, but Twist and Shout. Yeah, a week before The Devil's Chord, Bruce ended his show with a twist. There must be something in the air. Oh yeah, there is. It's called music. Anyway, the reason I point this out is that music has never been my thing, but I've always appreciated it. My first mixtape was made up of songs I had heard coming from my brother's eclectic record collection, all bought cheap from the local Oxfam, but containing everything from The Doors to Talking Heads to, Holst. Yep, that mixtape of mine had Riders from the Storm and Wild Wild Life and Mars from the Planets on it. I told you it was eclectic. Oh, but my, I was proud of my curation, and I played that tape over and over again. Oh, for the young, hello, a mixtape was like a playlist, but you actually had to physically put it together yourself on a thing called a cassette, which you had to turn over halfway through. Now, a real maestro would time theirs so well that no song was cut short by a tape coming to an end. He didn't want that. Nor was there too much dead air before the tape clicked to silence and a stop. Now, that was a skill passed down through generations that, I fear, like basket weaving, tying knots and having the consideration not to vape on public transport, will soon be lost forever. I needed a mixtape, though, because prior to that, my personal collection of music consisted almost entirely of two 12-inch vinyl records. The Trial of a Time Lord theme, with the extended Mankind Disco version on the back, I think they call it a B-side, which I loved but didn't resemble anything happening in the discos my schoolmates were going to, that's for sure. And the Doctor Who The Music album, which, oh good lord, I tried to like. Malcolm Clark's famed Sea Devil's Suite, I'd read about it and, actually, subsequently discovered, was so affecting and disorienting in the story itself, but listened to for pleasure, orphaned, when it sounded like Charlie the Cat being throttled as he coughs up a furball made of electric Brillo pads. The score for Ark of Infinity, which seemed perfectly fine when I'd watched it on the TV, made anyone passing my bedroom think that an ambulance was going through a robotic mangle with indigestion. Ark of Infinity was, of course, scored by the mighty Roger Limb, whose music works much better accompanying the pictures than as the soundtrack to a teenager's bedroom. And if Roger were playing in a concert today and said, "My son has been in Doctor Who," I'd shout out from the back, all emotional, Yeah, I'd say. He's Jeremy Lim, who played Timothy Drake in The Devil's Chord. It's a thing about being a grown-up, and in the industry, that one's Facebook friends, and Jeremy is one of mine, start popping up in the show that you love. I've had two this week, actually. And when one of them is a Doctor Who fan, as Jeremy is through and through, and the son of a composer, and the other is a legendary costume designer who now does some acting, hello, June Hudson, the costume designer of Legopolis, yeah, man, then, yeah, I get a little emotional. I love you, Doctor Who. The thing is, I'd expected this podcast to be about the Beatles. That was the plan when I knew this episode was coming up. There are obvious parallels, of course. The Beatles released their first single on exactly the same day that a screen legend, oh yeah, released the first instalment of a franchise that runs to this day. Sadly, it's not Doctor Who, though. Because a year before, that wheezing, groaning sound was first heard coming from Totter's Lane, on the 5th of October 1962, the Beatles' first single, Love Me Do, was released on the same day that cinemas welcomed another Doctor, Dr. No, into the world. The debut of James Bond, as we know him. Yes, I know about Casino Royale, put your ruler away. But even though they don't share a birthday, there are several connections between the Fab Four and the Fab, 15, the Doctors Who. Both of them dominated their corner of 60s culture, of course, and both provoked their own kind of dash mania. The term Beatlemania was coined in 1963 to describe the frenzy and brouhaha that orbited the Liverpool Quartet, a carefully constructed foursome who each brought something different to the table. Mercurial John, sensible Paul, Ringo, the emotional glue who held the band together. It even needed a kid to get into trouble, a George. And the Daleks first appeared in 1963 too, just. And the earliest use of the word Dalek mania, I have found, is August 1964, so, you know, there wasn't a huge gap between those two manias. And so it's only fitting that the Beatles are the first band to appear in Doctor Who. That small fragment of their specially pre-recorded appearance on Top of the Pops in 1965 only survives because it's featured in episode 1 of The Chase. The original plan, apparently, had been to feature the band themselves in aged makeup, still together as elderly men. A nice gag, but one vetoed by their producer, Brian Epstein. Instead, we get a different joke. Vicky didn't realise they played classical music, she says. Lovely. In some ways, the fact that this potential coup, the Beatles recording special material for an episode of Doctor Who, actually guest starring in it, the fact that it didn't happen is a relief for many Doctor Who fans, whose initial response to the death of John Lennon in 1980 would have been that The Chase was now historically inaccurate. Now, I'm not going to list all of the Beatles' appearances and references in Doctor Who. That's more for a list kind of podcast. And remember what I said about quantifying fun. But suffice to say, if Harry's Cafe had opted to play I Have a Dog, He's Called Fred, instead of Do You Want to Know a Secret, then the DVD release of Remembrance of the Daleks would have caused Mark Ayres fewer headaches, I'm sure. I didn't actually have the Beatles on any of my mixtapes, but I didn't need them. They were on the radio often enough. In fact, if I'm honest, my second attempt at a mixtape featured songs from Doctor Who. Not music, not incidental music. No, 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 that would have been sad. But, you know, songs, proper songs. Slim pickings, I know. And I include, although the word song is a stretch here, Three Guitars Mood 2. The twangy instrumental Susan listens to in An Unearthly Child, which purports to be by John Smith and the Common Men, and how lovely that an earlier incarnation of that band is lovingly referenced in The Devil's Chord with the glimpse of a poster for Chris Waits and the Carolers. Those three moody guitars, though, are at least tuneful in a shadowsy kind of way. But I'll never forget the look on my sister's face as she spied me desperately trying to enjoy myself listening to poorly recorded off-air mixes of The Ballad of the Last Chance Saloon and Robot King John's celebration of war from the King's demons, and rightly deciding that, well, I'm a loser. But apart from some period-evoking numbers performed by characters from and in Delta and the Bannermen, actual songs in Doctor Who have been few and far between. And even when they were there, they were in the background. So when I first watched Patrick McGoohan's groundbreaking mix of social commentary and adventure yarn, The Prisoner, it seemed so much more sophisticated than my show. Using the Beatles, of course, it'd have to be the Beatles, to illustrate, caustically, the cruel juxtaposition between the peace and love espoused in 60s popular culture and the grim realities of the Vietnam War echoing behind it. The last episode of The Prisoner features a machine gun massacre, ironically backed by the Beatles' All You Need Is Love, in a memorable sequence that seemed so unlike anything Doctor Who did, or indeed anyone did. And so this week I observed with glee that when the Doctor was trapped in the drum in the Devil's Cord, his face stretching its alabaster skin as he struggled to escape, it was with a visual that reminded me of the terrifying, breathless captives of the prisoner's balloon Sentinel Rover, whose similar effect on wayward villagers created one of that series' most memorable and unsettling visuals. The 60s Doctor Who episode paying homage to one of the 1960s most groundbreaking and imaginative shows. But for Doctor Who, it took until Russell T. Davies' relaunch in 2005 for the show to demonstrate how effective music could be as an underscore, ironic or not, to the drama. Popular music, I mean. The Sun burned the steward of Platform One in the end of the world as Britney Spears' Toxic echoed through the station. And then the Master, Last of the Time, lauded it over his stricken enemy to the strains of the Scissor Sisters, having, a week earlier, ordered the decimation of the Earth's population to Voodoo Child by Rogue Traders in The Sound of Drums, because, as Rogue Traders said, here come the drums, here come the drums. Suffice to say, when first experimenting with making a playlist on iTunes, which was then the latest version of the mixtape, those three songs were straight in. The fact that they'd been in Doctor Who was something my family and friends were blissfully unaware of. I'm just a man of eclectic tastes. Personally, I love this stuff. Pop songs accompanying the action. It uses modern music to commentate on and augment the action in a way that makes an old fart like me feel engaged and invigorated. The world burning to toxic made the show, in the early days of its resurrection, feel, amongst that burning heat of the sun, pretty cool. And so, it's not unusual for songs to feature in the show now, but The Devil's Chord, well, that did something different. Indeed, there are fewer Beatles songs, actually, in The Devil's Chord than there are in Evil of the Daleks. Instead, we get songs, music, not only as the driver of the plot in The Devil's Chord, but as a metaphor for life. Just like trying to evaluate the ephemeral, trying to measure how art, music, creativity, how they impact our lives, well, it's impossible. All we know is that without them, our life would definitely be poorer. It's the small, beautiful things, after all, that life is all about. And a well-prepared meal is always a bit more special if there's some romantic music accompanying it in the background. Definitely of the diegetic variety. Oh, and that gag was on song. The Devil's Chord made me think about music. It was a paean to the power of creativity. How appropriate, then, that the climax hinged not on a musical genius, no, but on the alchemy between Lennon and McCartney, two geniuses together, whose initial chance meeting on a bus was a confluence of space and time and talent which changed the world forever. So how appropriate that only the magical alignment of those two stars could send the maestro twisting and shouting back into the ether. An apposite end for a villain was pitch perfect, and I say that as someone with no prior knowledge of Jinx Monsoon. it should surprise no one that RuPaul's Drag Race and I have never quite hung out in the same time-space event, but who struck me as being in tune with any number of enjoyable, scenery-chewing villains of the past. And this one, delightfully, gobbled a helping of music or two down as, appropriately, an accompaniment. It's different, though, and Davis, Russell T., who isn't just Doctor Who's Lennon and McCartney, I think he's its George and Ringo too, seems to be going through his surrealist phase. Fans of Love Me Do will have found I Am the Walrus, you know, off of the Three Doctors, a little avant-garde for their tastes, but history tells us they're all part of the same canon. I'm guessing, but this phase of Doctor Who's magical mystery tour seems to be favouring the fantastical, and it's making a bit of a song and dance about it. The Devil's Chord says that music is magical. Now listen, I can't read, sing, or even describe music. But I know that a song that reminds me of a happy or sad moment in my life can lift my heart or break it. Music is capable of transporting me through time without me even having to leave the sofa. I can never hear, and it's the Beatles again, Here Comes the Sun, without thinking of my mate playing it at the funeral of another mate who's now been dead for, what, 34 years. But I can see him now, and I can hear that tune too on my friend Robin's guitar echoing around the church. Music can bring the dead back to life, as long as they're here. They're with us. As someone so often stuck in the past anyway, I've recently been watching The Ambassadors of Death and lamenting that modern TV is so regimented that we'd never get an opening these days that played with the established formula like The Ambassadors of Death does when its title crashes onto the screen after the reprise of the previous week's cliffhanger. And then the maestro's piano tinkled into the titles and the music played out on the TARDIS jukebox. Oh, thank you, the Devil's Chord. Or should that be the Devil's Kapow Chord? And I know that having something funky and exciting blasting in my ears, oh yeah, I have at least three or four Spotify playlists these days, and one of them has no Muddy Gold or Jonathan Gibbs on it at all, can make me, even me, feel, even if just for a moment, transported from the world of being a creaky, geeky 50-year-old man to someone who walks with a spring in his step, daring in that private moment of rhapsodic disappearance to feel, maybe, despite all external evidence to the contrary, just a little cool, even if it's only in here. And whilst music isn't a massive part of my life, I do have something that has been the accompaniment to my days, that evokes memories and loves and losses, that excites me and comforts me and moves me, and that, yes, lifts me and devastates me and makes me soar. And that's Doctor Who. Now, excuse me whilst I go and add California Soul to my Spotify playlist. Thank you so much for listening to Indefinable Magic. Play on, after The Devil's Chord. It was written and presented by me, Toby Haydock. The podcast artwork is by Dylan Patterson. And the music, I hope it lifts you and devastates you and makes you soar, it definitely does me, was specially composed by Dominic Glynn. I'd like to thank the patrons who make these podcasts possible, and they include Ruben Herfindahl, Stephen Moffat, Ronald Hayden, Paul Hayes, Matthew Herbert, Stephen Hill, Simon Hodges, Andrew Hodgson, Sam Hollingsworth, Matthew Houliston, Darren Howard, Tom Hunter Watts, Steve Herr, Paul Ingerson, Ed Jefferson, Robert Jewell, Judith Jackson, William Keith, Peter Kelly, James Kersey, Matthew Kilburn, Colin Kilpatrick, Andy Kitching, Chris Knight, Hendrik Korzeniowski, Aaron Kokilovsky, Pete Lack, Pete Lambert, Andy Larson, Erica Lear, Jonathan Letarger, Paul Lindblad, Neil Little, Mark Ledsam, Andrew Lester, Andrew Llewellyn, and Paul Loveday. If you would like your name read out on the credits, well, that's one of the bonuses of being a patron. You can become one of those by going to patreon.com/Toby Haydoke, where for as little as £3 a month, well, you get your name read out on the credits, but you also get advance releases, bonus material, pictures, interviews. You get the podcasts a good 6 months in advance if it's Happy Times and Places and Indefinable Magic, apart from these ones, which are hot off the press, so you know, you only get them about 24 hours early, but these are a special case. But yeah, you get them at least a month or two in advance for all most of the podcasts. And you also get a bonus podcast called Far Too Much Information, and you get monthly AMAs, which are exclusive as well as looks at the documentaries and commentaries that I do on the DVD and Blu-ray range for you, behind the scenes things, that sort of thing. Little as £3 a month, as I say, and you get 10% off that and off any of the other tiers if you sign up for a year in advance. There's nothing on the higher tiers that is too exclusive. You get all the material, all the podcasts, all the bleh, content at the lowest level. It's a kind of pay what you can sort of affair. It seems the fairest and nicest and least embarrassing way of doing it, he says as he as he solicits for cash, which you can also donate via ko-fi.com/Toby Haydoke if you don't want to get tied up to a monthly thing and you're not interested in bonuses and having your inbox ping with the various bits and bobs of material. But it's a way of supporting an independent artist, which is what I am. But look, if you are just happy to consume these, you know, when they come out on iTunes and for free, which is absolutely fair enough and how most people do it, and I'm grateful because there's a lot of you listeners out there, and you know, you make it worthwhile me spending the time doing this. But the numbers can grow if people like your good selves go to iTunes and Podbean and Spotify and all the places online and give these 5 stars. And a few lines of positive review. It really helps these podcasts to stand out from the crowd, and it's really needed in this day and age when Doctor Who podcasts are seemingly everywhere and are very good. There's so much good stuff out there. So any help you could get to tweak my algorithms would be greatly appreciated and would cost you nothing but a little bit of your time, which would be appreciated. You can also do all the social media stuff. These podcasts have their own feed at Haydoke Podcasts. I have my own feed too, at Toby Haydoke. Those are both on Twitter, currently known as X, but, you know, I'm still on the Opal Fruits stage of my life, and I'm never calling anything Snickers. Calling a singular thing a plural name? No thanks. I much prefer to call my chocolate bar after a race that you definitely couldn't run if you ate too many of them. Anyway, listen up. What was that about? Twitter. Yeah, Twitter at Haydoke Podcasts, at Toby Haydoke. I'm on Instagram at Toby.Haydoke. I have a page on Facebook, not my personal page. I'm trying to migrate anybody that's interested in my work away from that onto the page for me as a comedian, performer, you know, producer of stuff. So I is it called a fan page? It might be. I balk at that. But yeah, my Facebook page, I think you can like or follow or something, and you get all my sort of professional stuff there, which means that I can do more personal stuff on my personal page. I've got to get round to getting rid of people off that, but it feels like I'm executing them. Anyway, basically do the social media thing, including Instagram, because I'm putting videos and things on there as well. So I'd be very grateful. Okay, these are supposed to be shorter than your usual Indefinable Magics because they're called bite size, and it's currently becoming a bite that only someone with an enormous mouth could cope with. So let's let's stop now. But yeah, look, this at the moment, I don't know how these are going to go. This is an experiment, but I quite enjoy performing that. So I hope you enjoyed listening to it. It's there's loads of brilliant people out there reviewing the episodes. Some getting cross, some getting enthused. So I've sort of taken a side swerve and gone, well, I'll do this instead. So that was that. I hope it wasn't a waste of your time and mine. And now for my song and dance routine. No, believe me. I mean, one, the fact that it's on audio, but yeah, you definitely don't need a musical ending from me. Although it might be the end of music as we know it.